One announcement that I'd like to make, actually, two, let me just start briefly with, there was some discussion of going to the farmer's market tomorrow, that Neil was going to maybe go up with you guys, so we're not, I guess, how many people are interested in doing that? Because a lot of you have been, okay. So we just need to find out exactly when the train, what? Oh, for going to the farmer's market tomorrow, a Saturday little outing that Neil would go with you guys? And then there's the question of what time the train leaves. I don't know if anyone, what's that? 10 and noon. So you'd prefer 10? It's, is that okay for everybody? Okay, so where do you want to meet, Neil? On the platform at 10. Okay, so that's the first thing. 10 to 10, yeah, just to make sure, yeah, you guys get together. Okay, so the other thing is you too. So I guess someone already mentioned that that this might be some unitary group, or perhaps it's the scattering amplitude for gravitons.
The oldest rock band of all time.
Okay, yes. Okay, so Nima got the right answer. So I have to say I know nothing about any of those three things, but I do know that apparently Research in Motion is sponsoring a national tour. Is it an international tour? It's an international tour of this rock band, U2, and they. And they are providing the Perimeter Institute with a block of tickets to a concert which will take place in Toronto on September what? 16th. Okay, and so the question is anyone interested in going to that? We will arrange transportation. Who's interested? I guess, is anyone not interested in going to that? Okay, so we will take the, we will work on the assumption that everyone wants to go, and then we'll, you'll have tickets, and yeah, if you don't want to go, yeah, because there are other people. Dennis, you're not going? Okay, so I unfortunately, fortunately, will be in Kyoto at the time, so I won't be going. Okay, so that was my announcement. Neil, did you have something? Okay. Oh, that's right. It's at 4 o'clock, right, over at the Perimeter Institute. So, okay, so we have a short presentation on 2 minutes, okay, on the quantum cosmos. It's better to
All right. You think U2 is an opportunity. I have even better opportunity for it. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the general manager of outreach downstairs. If you're ever looking for me, I'm downstairs in the back right-hand corner. And I'm showing you where I live because I'm hoping you're going to come visit me. We have a conference. It's called Q2C, Quantum to Cosmos, happening in October. For 10 days, we're hoping to have 45,000 people through in person, and then hundreds of thousands online. So it's quite a big deal. We've been working for about a year to put this whole thing together. What I'm here to do today is to give you just a snapshot into where perhaps you could really help out. And hopefully it's an opportunity for you too. We will have a tent at the Waterloo Square, just down the road there. We're going to have a giant tent, and in the tent we're going to have all sorts of physics exhibits targeted at a general audience. We're going to have a cloud chamber. We're going to have a giant human gyroscope, a two-person seated thing where they can spin around. Lots and lots of really hopefully exciting things for the general public to surf through and get a real sense of it. We are having high school students bust in at 200 an hour for about 6 hours a day, plus the general public. So, guess what we need? We need you. Each of the exhibits needs someone there who can share the excitement of physics and answer questions that the kids will have and the general public will have. So if that sounds like something that's fun to you, I want you to come down and visit me in the bottom right-hand corner downstairs, and we'll sign you up and we'll chat. In the end, it'll probably be 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, before we sit down together and really decide who will do what. But the type of help you can give is varied, from truly just being there to move around and be available for kids. On some occasions, we need actual short presentations to be given, where you would perhaps even be up on a little stage and giving a 10-minute scripted, planned out presentation. But if you wanted to be involved in the creation of that, your expertise and insight would be welcomed as well. So there's a varying degree of need, and what a wealth of opportunity for both you and me. So my name is Greg again, and downstairs, if you're interested, think about it. Come and see me. I'll sign you up, and then we'll don't worry, we'll train you completely. If you want to do it and you're scared to death, that's okay. That's we'll take you. Okay? Any questions?
So,
when is it? The 15th to the 25th of October. So I believe it's during your reading week, which isn't that ideal.
I smell a rat.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, yes, sorry.
Will the tent area then be where a lot of the speakers are? Or
We'll have speaking engagements in the tent. There's also formal presentations and lectures at the PI building. And there's also, at the Princess Cinema, we have school groups and public airings of different activities there as well, which also involve some lectures. So there's plenty of demand, certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Neil Lima.
Oh, thank you.
Game on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm going to leave these. You can surf through it. It's the first little brochure. Let's give you an idea. I don't want to distract you in the lecture, though, so I'll put it back in the corner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, is this on? So we've covered a lot of ground in four lectures. I hope, what I really hope to have done is show that some of the really absolutely frontier problems in research are actually related to very, very basic physical issues. They can be discussed in a quite concrete way. And at least the big picture problems are fairly easy to state, even if they may not be so easy to solve. And in the first lecture, I laid out a number of what these problems are. There are the problems having to do with putting together quantum mechanics and gravity, the fact that local observables don't seem to make sense, as well as the fine-tuning problems that we have, the hierarchy problem and the cosmological constant problem. And then we spent a little bit of time talking about the fine-tuning problems and other expectations for new physics that might be tested by experiments soon. We spent some time talking about the implications of the fact that there are no local observables, the fact that perhaps one should try to focus on things that can be calculated exactly and observed exactly in principle, which are things that you can measure at infinity and in flat space. Well, in negatively curved spacetimes, that's in principle a solved problem by the ADS-CFT correspondence. In flat spacetime, it is not yet a solved problem. And I started telling you some of the most basic things about how to think about scattering amplitudes, at least the kinematics of how to think about them properly, and told you that there might be some, that there's many, many indications that there is a second dual description of ordinary physics, gauge theories, and gravity that might make a lot of the astonishing properties of these amplitudes more manifest and really teach us something about a way of describing local physics in a non-manifestly local way. So today what I want to do is tell you about the last set of issues, which I mentioned in the first lecture are in many ways the most conceptually confusing ones of all, which involved how to talk about doing, well, where every single one of the things that are confusing come into play at the same time, quantum mechanics, gravity, and cosmology. And as I mentioned in the first lecture, the problem there is that it's not clear what even the precise observables are when you talk about quantum mechanics in a closed finite system, as seems to be the case for us in our universe, especially if the universe is accelerating. What we see in our universe now is what we get. We're not going to get access to more degrees of freedom. And even though it's an enormous number of degrees of freedom, and none of these things are matters of are of any immediate practical concern as far as limitations on what we can observe or compute are concerned, it's still disturbing that that there isn't any, in principle, precise mathematical meaning that you could associate to the observables that we would like to talk about. And that's because we can't make this infinite separation between infinitely large observers that can make experiments, infinitely large apparatuses that can make experiments infinitely many times, which is necessary to do quantum mechanics. And putting those infinitely large apparatuses near the boundaries of space-time are necessary in order to be able to do those experiments because of gravity. Well, both of these infinities are lost to us when we talk about cosmology. We can't, especially cosmology in our accelerating universe, we can't do the experiment infinitely many times, and we can't, more importantly, we can't separate the apparatuses from each other arbitrarily and hope to retrieve the information. Yes?
Back in the modern cosmology, people thought that there was a chance the universe could be time closed, so it would expand and then recollapse.
Right.
So in this case, like,
that would have been equally bad. Okay. That would have been equally bad. The thing that would have been fine, at least would have left us something quantum mechanical to compute, was, as I mentioned before, was what it was implicitly being done by people who talked about the wave function of the universe. The thing that would have been fine is if the universe just expanded forever, okay, and eventually got infinitely large, so that an observer sitting there in the universe, if they waited infinitely long, would see an infinitely large universe. And the kind of observable that you could compute would then be things like the fraction of stars that are blue, the fraction of stars that are red, okay? So those are things that could, in principle, be the output of a physical theory, a precise output of a physical theory, because there'd be infinitely many of every kind of thing, and you could minimally take, you could minimally just list how many of X there is, how many of Y there is, how many of Z there is, and make a prediction for those quantities. Unlike the S matrix, there's no access to the initial state. So that's why you don't talk about the S matrix. All you can talk about is the vector. You can just talk about the wave function itself. But what the output is, what the actual physical output would be in that situation, would be just predicting relative frequencies of different things happening in an infinitely large universe. Acceleration takes even that away from us. Okay, acceleration takes even that away from us. And so, so we're really left in a situation where we can't make this infinite separation between between system and apparatus. And so the very, the very rules of quantum mechanics, the very rules of how to talk about precise observables are lost. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
Well, you answered it in the course, so.
Okay.
I guess I'm still confused why this is such a big deal. Like, in a classical universe, you can not only predict relative frequencies, but you can predict everything that will ever happen.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It seems like the only thing you lose when you go to, say, a collapsing universe and an accelerating universe is that you you now have sort of a second layer of statistical uncertainty.
Well, I mean, so it's just that, no, so so none of this, of course, is a big deal for waking up tomorrow morning and brushing your teeth or whatever, okay? I mean, none of this is any practical big deal at all. But the question is there any, in principle, I mean, let's say someone said, I have a theory of everything. I have a theory of cosmology of everything. Great. What does this theory compute? Exactly. And that's something that you can compute precisely.
Okay? It seems like if you have a recollapsing image, for example, all you can do is predict the probability that you'll see a certain relative frequency.
You can't even do that. No. That no longer means anything. There's no actual sharp number that can come out of any experiment. Any experiment can last in that universe a finite amount of time with the access to a finite amount of
information. For example, if you have a theory that predicts that the probability you see half red stars and half blue stars is, 10 to the negative 9, and you do see half red stars and half blue stars, but still, the theory has still told you something. I mean, it told you the theory is wrong. You can still do like fit in. You can still find best fit models.
Well, So it could be that the answer is that we have to get used to some way of talking about things that even in principle don't have infinite precision. That's possible. But that's it's then incumbent upon us to figure out how to talk about things how to do that. How do we talk about things that don't have actual exact precision? That's never happened in the history of physics so far. It has never happened. I mean, a theory has an output, which is an equation, and it gives you a number. And the number is an unambiguous number. And it's associated with some, in principle, measurement that would yield that unambiguous number. So it's true that one, forgetting about what the theory is, every observation has some unambiguous fuzziness associated with it. When you are in this situation, when you're in an accelerating universe or a collapsing universe, but one where you have where you cannot make this distinction, this infinite distinction between the size of the apparatus, the number of times you can do the measurement, and the system. Now, that's just life. That's just true. The question is, what are you supposed to do in that situation? Maybe what you're supposed to do is to say every single thing, even the probabilities, have some fuzziness associated with them. But that's so very good. So then someone who says they have a theory has to tell you how to interpret that. Okay? And that becomes, by the way, what makes this all much, much less academic in this context is in the case where the universe is actually accelerating. Because if it's accelerating, then there is some mental picture in which even though any given observer sees a finite number of things, there's at least some imaginary picture where the universe is actually infinite and is getting larger and larger and larger. And then even very, very, very rare things are going to happen somewhere. And so you then have to start figuring out what you do about that. You see, this picture where tiny probabilities you just excise and throw out, that picture makes sense that picture makes perfect sense when the tiny probability is continuously connected to something which is zero. Okay? But in this picture of an inflating universe, there are infinitely large regions with all sorts of chances for even incredibly rare things to happen. And then you have to start wondering what you weight those probabilities by. Do you weight them by the volumes in this big region? Maybe there's way more volume in the places where these very rare things happen. And this starts turning into an incredibly thorny and strange issue. So this becomes again, a lot harder even. So from the point of view of a single observer, collapsing and expanding, collapsing or accelerating forever offer the same puzzles. There's even more puzzles in the case where it's expanding forever because of at least the mind's eye concern that there's an infinitely large universe where you start having infinity times zero or huge times small. Actually, really, really the problem is that in this picture, the volumes are actually infinity. So it's infinity times small. And then whenever you have infinity times small, then you really have to start wondering how to deal with that situation. OK, so this is an unsolved problem. This is a totally unsolved problem. But what I want to do in this lecture is set some of the very, very simple ground rules and at least tell you about parts of analogous questions that are completely understood. So at least you know what's understood and what isn't understood. And also to at least introduce you to some of the very basic notions that pop up in thinking about this business over and over again. So what I want to tell you about today, then, are two things which have to be understood properly in order to start attacking any of these cosmological questions. The first is simple things about quantum entanglement. And the second is simple things about horizons, regions of space-time from which you don't get regions of space-time that are boundaries that separate two regions where you can't have causal communication from one side to the other. Okay. So I want to start the discussion by talking about quantum entanglement. And in fact, in order to let me get a poll before I proceed. How many people know about are comfortable with decoherence? Great, very good, very good. All right, how many people? All right, great. So then we'll spend some time talking about that because it's a beautiful example of the importance of entanglement. Okay, so let me start by I'm going to ask two kinds of questions which turn out to be incredibly closely related to each other. One of them is a really incredibly simple question. Why does the world around us look classical? The world is quantum mechanical. Why does it look classical? What's the answer to this question that almost all of you have heard? What's a typical answer? Yeah.
Decoherence.
Did you put up your hand a second ago?
Huh? Your point. Yes.
Yeah, so the answer is decoherence. But the typical answer that at least yes.
Too many things that we don't.
Not just that. Not just that. Not simply that. Let me back up and say what the very naive answer is. The very naive answer is that big things are quantum mechanical, are classical. Small things are quantum mechanical. It's only when you get down to actions that are order h bar that things start looking quantum mechanical. But big things are classical, and this is actually nonsense. Because if you take a big bucket of superfluid, that's very quantum mechanical and it's a very big bucket. Okay, so that's a nice big quantum macroscopic phenomenon. Many, many other examples of macroscopic quantum phenomenon. So in fact, the distinction between classical and quantum is not, the distinction between classical and quantum is not big versus small. The distinction between classical and quantum is actually open versus closed. So when you have systems that interact with a large environment, those systems will very, very quickly become classical. And it's only small systems that are very, very shielded by interaction with the environment that can be put in highly quantum mechanical states. Yeah?
Before I get off the rails, are you saying do we need to make a distinction here between sort of like classical from the inside and classical from the outside? Like you say, when a system is interacting with the environment, it becomes classical.
Yeah, I just mean a very simple question. Why is it that when you walk into this room, we don't see that chair in the state one over root two there plus there? So, I mean, I'm really asking the question, why don't we see there's all sorts of incredible quantum mechanical states that, and we don't see them. Macroscopically in everyday life, we don't see them. Why? That is the question.
You could also say, you know, you walk into a room, you see the electron there instead of there. Like, but it seems like that would happen even without the environment, even if it were just you and the electron.
Well, I mean, we see electrons in highly quantum states all the time.
If you have like some sort of beam splitter where you fire an electron right at you and the beam splitter splits it, so either it goes into your left eye or your right eye, you always see it go into one eye.
No, so what I mean by C, that's because very good. So in fact, this question of why we only see classical like states is very, very closely related to the to what happens when you make a measurement on a quantum system as well. So in fact, exactly the same words, exactly the same basic message also explains the measurement process. So you don't have to invoke anything funny happening when a measurement is made. Certainly you don't have to invoke the consciousness of the observer or any nonsense like that. Measurement is nothing other than another ordinary physical phenomenon that happens to involve a system and an apparatus interacting with each other in an interesting way. And what we call a measurement takes place when the apparatus is much, much larger than the system. So indeed, so decoherence also explains why the outcome of measurement processes look like definite outcomes of with some probability seeing the electron go up, with some probability seeing the electron go down in some beam splitter. So we'll talk about both of those things. Yes.
When you say come into the room and see a chair there,
yes.
Don't you think it's because of the resolution of your eye, or maybe because the apparatus you're using to measure, that's why you can pinpoint the position of that chair. If you use something which has a very big resolution, realize that maybe the position is fluctuating based on the resolution.
No, as you'll see from this argument, even if it has nothing to do with the resolution of the eye, it has nothing to do with you or me at all. It has to do with the air molecules in the room. Okay? So I'm really asking a question. Why is it that typical initial states for the wave function of macroscopic things do not have do not look like I said, one over two, the chair there plus there. Okay. They do not look like that. What we see is the chair there. Or the chair might be there. But it's not an entangled state. We see macroscopic objects roughly in position at these states. And there's a very good reason for that. The reason for that, as we'll see, the reason for that is that these objects interact with local interactions with a large environment. And it's a property of that kind of interaction. It's a property of local interactions that makes position eigenstates a preferred basis in which things look classical. So actually, let me start this discussion off actually with the instead of talking about the environment, let me talk about measurement. So we talked about this briefly before, but let's say we have a spin a half system and it's in this wave function, alpha up plus beta down. Now, normally we say that this isn't some pure state. And then we say that this evolves. And if we make a measurement of the spin, we say that with probability alpha mod squared, it's measured to be up. And with probability beta mod squared, it's measured to be down. Now, you know that, let's forget about the measurement for a second. You know that there's a distinction to be made between quantum and classical uncertainties. I can have a definite quantum state psi. Okay? If I know I'm definitely in some quantum state psi, we say that we're in a pure state, and I can make any measurements on it. I can get anything that I want out of that. But we could also be in a situation where we don't know which quantum state we're talking about. This is like a classical uncertainty, right? We just don't know. Which state is it? If I have a bunch of states, then I think about it in terms of a density matrix, rho. And that reflects just my classical uncertainty, just like in statistical mechanics, just like in any, just I don't know which one of the states am I in. Okay? So if p psi is equal to 1 for one psi and 0 for all the rest of them, then I'm in a definite state. And the density matrix is corresponds to a pure state. But in general, it doesn't. So if I want to know the expectation value of any old operator, it's just the trace of rho times that operator, which is just the sum over psi of psi o psi times the probability of having the state psi. So this allows us to make a very clean distinction just by properties of the density matrix between quantum and classical kinds of uncertainty. Let's go to this state. So let's say I have the state alpha up plus beta down. Then so if psi, and let's say I definitely know I'm in that state, then the density matrix associated with that state is just some 2x2 matrix that I can write like this: alpha mod squared, beta mod squared, alpha beta star, alpha star beta. Okay, so if this is up, down, whatever, up, down, up, down. Okay, so this is alpha mod squared up, up, plus alpha beta star up, down, plus, and so on. Okay. Now, this matrix, if I'm not measuring anything, if the system has some Hamiltonian, is just evolving by unitary evolution. Okay. Just evolving by unitary evolution. But again, the textbook way of talking, at least the old textbook ways of talking about it, maybe some new textbooks are getting better. But the old textbook way of talking about it is then you do a measurement, and then something dramatic happens. You do a measurement, and right after the measurement, if before the measurement looked like this, and I do the measurement of the spin in this direction, let's say the z direction, then right afterwards, the wave function collapses. Some mysterious process. And the density matrix becomes rho after just becomes alpha mod squared 0, 0 beta mod squared. Okay? That's what it means that so if I do any future measurements on this guy, then it will be as if with probability alpha mod squared, it's just up, and with probability beta mod squared, it's down. But the density matrix afterwards doesn't have any of these off-diagonal terms, which are the hallmark of an interesting entangled state. So this is really technically what we say, right? We say that if this is what rho was before the measurement, then that's what rho is after the measurement. And it's completely clear this is not a unitary process, okay? So there's an absurd way of talking about this, which is that you evolve along with the Schrodinger equation, then you make a measurement. Everything is unitary, you make a measurement. Something horribly non-unitary happens. You replace the density matrix by manually rubbing off the off-diagonal components, then you merrily go along and you unitary evolve until you measure again. And so there's this continuous difference between the system evolving and being measured. Okay. Well, that's completely absurd. And that's, of course, also not what happens. So one message I want to give you in this lecture, which, you know, 30 years ago would not have been controversial, but is somehow controversial now, is that there's absolutely no mysteries about quantum mechanics. Okay. About quantum mechanics is applied to ordinary situations. There are mysteries, the mysteries I mentioned to you, cosmology, gravity, finite number of degrees of freedom, all that stuff. But for, you know, for measurements that you do in a lab involving a Stern-Gerlach experiment or any ordinary thing that does not use the words cosmology and gravity, okay, there's nothing funny about quantum mechanics. Okay? Everything is perfectly sensible, perfectly fine. As I said, these things were essentially figured out by Bohr and his friends a long time ago. They were said very cleanly and nicely by Zurek and other people 30 years ago. And this is a solved problem. Some people think it's not a solved problem. And this is one of the things where somebody is missing something. But I certainly don't see where the problem is. And so I want to paint, I at least want to talk to you about or tell you about a way of thinking about these things, which is utterly unmysterious. Okay? There's absolutely nothing mysterious in the measurement process. Let's just talk about what's actually happening. So really, a measurement is nothing other than a particular physical process. I just have a system and an apparatus and some interaction Hamiltonian between the system and the apparatus. Okay? Now, let's say that this apparatus is designed to measure the spin of the particle. Okay? Let's say it's designed to measure the spin of the particle. Then the job of this interaction Hamiltonian is to do the following. Okay? If you've made a good apparatus, its job is to do the following. Its job is to take the spin up, if you send it up, and have the apparatus start in this ground state, whatever the ground state of the apparatus is. So if you feed in this state, then in time, it should evolve to another state. You don't disturb the system much, but the apparatus is now in a different state. The apparatus is in a state where it's flashing a green light that says the spin is up. Okay? It's flashing, spin up. And it has another job. If you send down A equals ground, then this flashes the down times spin down. This doesn't happen for a totally random interaction Hamiltonian. If you have a crappy apparatus, it won't do this. Okay? But the whole point of building an apparatus to make a measurement is that it should do this. I think we'd all agree with that, right? If it's designed to measure spin up, if it's designed to measure the spin in the z direction, if I feed it spin up over and over again, it should always flash up over and over again. If I feed it spin down, it should flash down over and over again. Yes?
Totally correct me. How do you feed an apparatus spin up?
Huh?
How do you feed an apparatus spin up? Like, I want to know whether it's working or not, right? So I feed in a bunch of spin up particles.
Yeah.
I get spin up particles.
Sorry, what do you mean? I mean, you just take like a Stern-Gerlach experiment, and you feed in a bunch of identically prepared states, and when they go up. When they go up and they land into a bucket up here, something lights up.
So the point is I feed in identical.
Yeah, you just do it by feeding in identical things. You prepare a bunch of identical states and you just feed them in.
And if I take a Stern-Gerlach experiment, you know, that's with magnets oriented vertically, and then I have identically paired system.
Yeah.
Paired systems. I can feed them into my measuring apparatus, which is oriented horizontally, and I don't get. Like, I have identically paired,
If it's designed to measure, so what you do, what you really do, if you were dumb and you didn't know what your apparatus was measuring, then you would throw in, you'd prepare a bunch of identical things, oriented in random directions, and find something where when you sent it in, you kept getting the same answer again and again and again. Then you say, that's the component of spin that it's measuring. Okay? But this is the point, that someone who knows everything, who knows what the system is, who knows what the apparatus is, can design an interaction Hamiltonian to do what they like. Okay? So there are some, if it's measuring spin in some direction, there are some states that are going to always give it the same answer over and over again. All right. Now, the really critical point here, which I will talk about now because, we'll use it in a moment. The really critical point is that if this apparatus is big, is made of lots and lots of degrees of freedom, then those two states, spin up and spin down, are necessarily nearly orthogonal to each other, are essentially zero. Or by essentially, I mean they're of order e to the minus the number of degrees of freedom of the apparatus. Okay. Yes?
I don't understand what that would, sorry, I'm not, why is that?
So let's explain why it is.
I'm about to explain.
So the point is that when you have a huge Hilbert space, of the apparatus, it's made of lots and lots of little pieces. Okay, even if every little subpiece of that Hilbert space, even if the overlap between any two of the vectors is like 0.999, there's lots. Okay, they're really, really close to each other. If there's an enormous number of degrees of freedom, then the overlap between the whole state is like 0.999 to the n. Okay. But if n is 10 to the 30, this is an incredibly small number. The 0.99 doesn't matter. Okay. And if you actually just think about it, I mean, something flashing up, something flashing down, this is involving macroscopic collections of photons, macroscopic collections of everything going into the flashing green, flashing red, that there's zillions of particles, zillions of degrees of freedom in the apparatus that are different when it's up and down. And so that's just enough to make, in fact, really, the typical, if I take any two states in a gigantic Hilbert space, it's very, very easy for their overlap to become zero, just for the reason that I said. Okay. Yes. This. Well, no. I mean, this. This is. Yeah. I mean, if you like, you might want to design it so that those. You might want to further design the interaction Hamiltonian. You could probably further design the interaction Hamiltonian to make that overlap exactly zero, if you liked. Okay, but anyway, I mean, even if you're not so careful to do it, I mean, say, this is not some abstracting any physical measurement that's like, there's a dial here versus a dial here. Okay, it went this way, it went that way. There's a gigantic number of degrees of freedom in that dial. Okay, the wave functions of the dial here and the dial there, that overlap is perhaps not exactly zero, but is exponentially small in the number of things that make up the dial. Yes?
Here is, it wasn't the process of measure. This special process of measurement was not mysterious in the first place.
Oh, no, so I'm not done yet.
Okay.
So this is what a good apparatus should do. Now let's hand it the general state, alpha up plus beta down. this state evolves just by linearity into alpha up, flashing up, plus beta down, flashing down. So this initial state, alpha up plus beta down, which is initially just the product of a state in the system times a state in the apparatus, has evolved into something that you could call an entangled state between the system and the apparatus. It has one piece, the alpha, the up piece, which is entangled with the state up in the apparatus, and the down piece, which is entangled with the state down in the apparatus. Okay? This new state cannot be written as a state in the system times a state in the apparatus. That's the general notion of entanglement. When you have two Hilbert spaces, A and B, then if you have a state which is a direct product of a state in A times a state in B, then you say they're not entangled with each other. But if it's a sum over states of that form, any state is a sum over states of that form, but if it can't be reduced to something which is just a direct product of one in one and one in the other, then you say that the state is entangled between A and B, for obvious reasons, right? All right. So this is what's going on in the entire, in the whole entire system of system, in the whole entire physical system of system plus apparatus. But let's say I want to make, I want to talk about an observable, which is just made out of the spin of the particle here. Okay. So in general, some system observable, call it O system. So this is the new big state, right? This is the new big state psi of everything. So let's ask the question, what is the expectation value of any system observable? Well, what was it to begin with? So let me, what was it to begin with? Well, to begin with, when I started, these operators only depend on S, the spin. So the ground piece here just gives me 1. And so all I'm left with in the beginning, at the beginning, what I'm left with is just the alpha up, alpha star up, plus beta star down, O system, alpha, up plus beta down. Right? Just the expectation value of O system in the initial state. But what do I get afterwards? What do I get afterwards? Well, what I get afterwards is, so I have to sandwich this whole state. So let me just even write it down very explicitly, right? So alpha star up, let me just abbreviate that as flashing up, plus beta star down, flashing down, times O system times alpha up, up, plus beta down, down. Well, so what is this? Well, let's look at the first piece. The first piece is alpha mod squared times up O system up. The next piece is, there's a piece that looks like O system, you know, up, down. So let's write it down, alpha star beta, up O system down. But it's multiplied by something. It's multiplied by the overlap of up and down. Then I have the Hermitian conjugate of this guy. And finally, I have plus beta mod squared times down O system down. Okay. Now, in fact, this is of exactly the same form as that. It's just that where I had before up flashing and down flashing, they both started off as the apparatus and the ground state. So right before the measurement, this overlap was 1. But as we just said, right after the measurement, this overlap is minuscule. Because the apparatus is so large compared to the system, this overlap is tiny. So let's just forget about these guys. They're exponentially small. They're like e to the minus 10 to the 30. Okay? But that means that after the measurement, any expectation value that I want to compute is as if, with probability alpha mod squared, I was in the state up. Classical probability alpha mod squared, I was in state up. And beta mod squared, I was in state down. That's measurement. It looks measured because I'm not keeping track of every single atom in the apparatus. Okay? If I'm just looking at the system, then the fact that the different spin components are leaving macroscopically different footprints in the apparatus is what gives rise to something that looks effectively like something that looks effectively probabilistic, classically probabilistic from the point of view of just the system. Okay? That probability is very simply reflecting our ignorance about the precise states of the apparatus with which the system was entangled. The whole state remains pure. The whole big state of system plus apparatus remains pure. But the system is entangled with the apparatus now. And if I restate this in the language of the density matrix, I would say the following. There's this very nice notion of a reduced density matrix. See, if I want the expectation value of O, this is trace of rho times O, always. But if this only depends on the system, then this trace is a trace over the system, but also a trace over the apparatus of rho times O system. And if O doesn't depend on the apparatus variables, I can do the trace over the apparatus first. This object is called the reduced density matrix, rho reduced. And so we see that the expectation value of any system observable is some reduced density operator for the system times O subsystem. So even though we have unitary evolution for the whole big density matrix, rho, started off as a pure state in this example, the reduced density matrix doesn't have to evolve unitarily. In fact, it doesn't evolve unitarily. And we just saw what it did. I can repeat this computation in the language of the density matrix. I'm just literally rewriting it in the language of the density matrix. So if I look at the state up plus down times alpha star up plus beta star down. That's what the density matrix is. So this would be alpha mod squared up plus beta mod squared the other way around but there are these famous off-diagonal components. Now, what happens when I trace over the apparatus? When I trace over the apparatus, I literally mean So if I trace over the apparatus, you know, the state up, the state down, let's say, this is literally the sum over some complete set of states in the apparatus, n up, down, n. I can move that over here. This is a sum over n down, n up. So this is otherwise known as just the overlap of down and up. So the trace just takes these two apparatus pieces and just replaces them by their inner product. So that's rho. This is rho. This is rho full. But rho reduced is then the first piece is alpha mod squared up, up, plus beta mod squared down, down, but then there's alpha beta star up down, but its coefficient is the overlap. And as we just said, because of the macroscopic property of the apparatus, that off diagonal piece has gone to zero. So this is how what looks like an effective measurement, effective reduction of the wave function, is actually nothing other than unitary evolution in the entire big system. Now, people get some people say this still doesn't solve the problem. Minimally, ignoring whether things, ignoring any interpretation questions. This shows you that there's some physical process. I mean, I can treat the measurement process as a physical process. You might even imagine screwing with the measurement process a little bit. You know, screw with the interaction Hamiltonian. Maybe don't make it so that it does these perfect things. Observe what it does. I mean, the entire process of measurement is something that you can experiment with, play with. It's a standard part of physics. It's not some detached thing from everything else. Okay. Now, I just want to quickly mention, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just want to quickly mention, before I do that, oh no, I'm talking about measurement now, so I should do it. Some people wonder, well, why is it that this is all fine and good, but we still don't understand why it is that that after we do a measurement, we do one measurement. After we do this one measurement, we either see the electron go with spin up or we see it with spin down. We never feel it in this entangled state, okay? So isn't this some deep mystery that we have to understand? Well, this is the answer to that question. So let's say that we have the system up, the apparatus is flashing that it's up, and then if I'm a good experimentalist, then my brain has to interact with the apparatus in such a way that after I see that it's flashing up, I know that it's up. I think it's up. Okay, so that's the state of that is the state of everything, including me. Okay. And okay, there's beta down, down, I think down. You see, now people complain and say that this is not a definite state. I mean, you know, I don't somehow feel disconnected in two different worlds with alpha and beta. Something definite happens at the end of every experiment. Okay. Why is it that that one senses a definite outcome of every experiment? The problem with these questions is that they're all fine questions, but you have to ask them in quantum mechanics. You don't get to ask them just using words and then gaze at your navel for a long time. You have to ask this question quantum mechanically. So what would it mean? What would it mean to feel a definite outcome of some experiment? There has to be some operator. This argument goes back a really long way, really long time, but was most nicely said by the late and very great Sidney Coleman. You have to invent an operator that tells you who's a definiteness operator. Okay? An operator that says you're definitely whose eigenvalues are designed, maybe are one or zero, so they're designed to tell you whether there's a definite outcome or not. So let's define such an operator. Whatever it is, there is some such operator. I don't know the theory of consciousness, but it's quantum mechanics, so there's some operator in the whole big world which has to have the property of the following. It's a definiteness operator that if I feed it the state up, I think up, that it gives me 1 times the same state, that this is an eigenstate of the definiteness operator. We'd agree with that, right? That's what happened, definitely something. That state is an eigenstate of the definiteness operator with eigenvalue 1. If I send it the state down, I think down, that's also something else with eigenvalue 1. And every other state, it should give me 0. That's the definition of the definiteness operator. Yes?
In general, like, I can do lots of different experiments, right? Like I can look in the apparatus and check whether it's like flashing green or flashing red, or I can like look at a needle and see if it's here or there. I can look like all these different things, and it seems so. First of all, it seems somewhat implausible to me that all of these different bases, the I think up, I think down basis, the I think left, I think right basis, it seems implausible to me that all of these bases are entirely orthogonal each other. Like, it seems like...
Well, I mean, they're order e to the minus 10 to... It's not implausible because of the giganticness of you and the apparatus.
Well, but again...
Typical states have
typical
overlap.
Typical states have very small overlap.
Right.
But typical states do not have zero overlap. Almost no states have zero overlap.
Well, they're not zero. They're not zero. They're all exponentially small. So that's why, that's why you have to make apparatuses infinitely large. But I'm talking about the this would take a little bit longer. This would take a little bit longer to talk about properly. But in practice, when we do all of these things, in practice, when we say that a state is an eigenstate of an operator with some eigenvalue, right, and then it has a definite value, and otherwise it has normally we say otherwise it has a value with a probability. Just hold on a second. Then there's a way of doing things where you never even have to talk about the probability. Okay? Instead, you talk about a confidence. You say that if a state is almost an eigenstate of an operator within a certain epsilon, then you say with a confidence delta, 1 minus delta, it has a definite value. Then there's a limiting procedure that you can take, where if you do the experiment infinitely often with an infinitely big apparatus, it's possible to take these epsilons and deltas to zero to arrive at a perfectly sharp number. Okay? And in so doing, you can even eliminate the probability postulate of quantum mechanics. In so doing, simply by doing the experiment over and over and over again, you build a gigantic state which comes closer and closer and closer to being the eigenstate of an operator called the probability operator. Okay? And the state approaches, in the limit where you do the experiment infinitely times, any state approaches and becomes an eigenstate of that operator with eigenvalue alpha mod squared or beta mod squared or the usual probability rules. Okay? So that's why it's true that the states aren't exactly orthogonal, but there's a way of talking about this which puts in some epsilon and delta and gives you a way of attaching a confidence to any given measurement. We do that as a crutch because it's possible in normal situations to take those epsilons and deltas to zero and get a completely sharp answer in principle. That's what's blocked in cosmology and gravity and all of those things that we talked about. Okay? But you're absolutely right. In order to really strictly make these arguments, I'm assuming these things are zero, In a real situation, they're not exactly zero, and so really you attach a confidence. Yeah. 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 Right. That's because the vast majority of the time I'm not making the measurement of the spin of a particle in a lab somewhere. Okay. It's not the so right. Well, so if you like, this is a definiteness operator associated with this experiment. But this is some operator in the Hilbert space whose job is to do this, right?
Okay, so there are these two eigenstates. I think I'll write it down. And now we'll just design an operator whose eigenvectors are precisely, I think, up an eigenbound and call that the definiteness operator. Like, why?
Oh, no, it isn't cheating because there are all kinds of states for which, for example, as it should be, if this is up, that's flashing down, and this is, I think, up, then I'm not definite. I'm just confused. Okay? So. If there's, I would really say the onus is the other way around. You know, if by the way, let me just finish the argument, and I'll give you an analog for this, which is much less airy fairy, and where you see that literally precisely the same argument works. But anyway, just to finish the story, starting the same thing with down. Then, as you see, the point is that any linear combination of up and down is also an eigenstate for the definiteness operator with eigenvalue 1. So as long as the experiment was well designed, and your brain is well designed, okay, then you're indefinite of the outcome of any experiment. Now, so a common reaction to this is that you're cheating. And I challenge you to come up with any notion of a definiteness operator which does not agree with this one. Maybe there's a bigger notion of definiteness for the outcome of anything, but whatever it is for this experiment, it has to reduce to this on any one of these states. And as soon as it reduces it to any one of these states, it reduces it to it on any linear combination of them. Yeah?
Well, it seems like, for example, I could define on my Hilbert space an operator, a proposition projection operator, like I am seeing something in a quantum superposition. And it doesn't matter, like, I don't have to say details, I can just do it. But, and then you figure some states, at least, there'll be eigenvalues from this state, and I can do my experiment in that eigen. You know, I can do that experiment in that basis. Or rather, you know what I'm saying, right? You can do...
No, I don't, actually.
Okay.
Have this. So, can I give you an example? Can I give you a non-bullshit example of this?
Sure.
And this example goes back to Turing in the 30s, who asked the following question: Why is it that when you have some kind of resonance, any kind of unstable state in a cloud chamber? Okay, people were doing experiments with cloud chambers. Let's say you have an S wave resonance, okay, and it decays. Why is what you get coming out of the cloud chamber a straight track? Why do you see a straight track? It's an S wave. It's a rotationally invariant state. So how come there's one experiment, right? No millions of experiments. Every time one of them goes off, poof, what comes out is a straight line. How is that consistent with the fact that it's actually an S wave? Okay. This is exactly the same question. This is precisely the same question. The reason for this is actually, once again, a combination of decoherence and this definiteness operator, except instead of the definiteness operator in this case, is it a line operator? Is it a straight line operator? So what happens is that S wave is actually a linear superposition of, if you like, would give you a linear superposition of momentum states moving out in all possible directions. Because of the local interactions between whatever the particle coming out is and the particles in the cloud chamber, any one of those states moving out in the given direction, any one of those states correlates, becomes entangled with something in the cloud chamber, which is things lining up in a line. Right? That's just so, and that's again just because the interactions are local, right? So something moves here, it hits something in the cloud chamber there, the next hits the cloud there, and so on. So the whole state of the cloud chamber and the particle, even though the particle is in an S wave, the whole state becomes entangled with particle moving in that direction, and the cloud chamber is seeing it in that direction. Okay? The cloud chamber is lighting up with excitations in that direction. And then you average it over all of them. But why is it that after any given experiment, any one experiment, you see a line? It's because of the same thing. You have to ask, you have to invent an operator. Is it a line operator? Okay? The is it a line operator should take something which acts on a state of the cloud chamber, you know, with hits in a line, and gives you one, and otherwise gives you zero. The S wave is a linear superposition of states like that with equal weight, and is therefore an eigenstate of the is it a line operator with the same eigenvalue, with eigenvalue one. So this is exactly the same argument. And so any question about this, if you're getting confused about it has nothing to do with our brain or anything like that. It's already a question about why it is that when a single S wave goes off in a cloud chamber, what you see is coming out as straight lines. Okay. So yes.
If I understood correctly, the basic assumption of all this argument is that the world is in any scale governed by quantum mechanics.
Absolutely.
So is the assumption justifiable? I mean, quantum mechanics is in principle impossible to formulate, to be formulated without classical mechanics.
Well, that's just what we're talking about. It's not that it's impossible to be formulated without classical mechanics. That's certainly not true. It's impossible to be formulated without infinitely large Hilbert spaces. That's what's true. You don't have to say the word classical mechanics once. It's not possible to formulate without infinitely large Hilbert spaces, an infinitely large Hilbert space for an apparatus. That apparatus, whether or not it becomes classical, is then a consequence of how the apparatus and the systems interact with each other. So things. So it's really very much the other way around. It's really very, very much the other way around. You have a big quantum mechanical system. It has an interaction. If you can separate into gigantic systems that you call an environment or an apparatus, and the subpieces, smaller pieces, then the interaction Hamiltonian will have the property that the interaction Hamiltonian will entangle pieces of the system with pieces of the apparatus. Then there's some special basis which is picked out by this interaction. There's a special basis of states in the system which will evolve, and what these states are will change depending on what the interaction is. Okay? But there's some special states of the system that will approximately evolve in time to, if they don't start entangled, they will not ever get entangled. Okay? So if you start with a state which is system times environment, then it'll just keep evolving roughly in a factorized form, system times environment. Okay? That's a special basis of states. Now, if you take in the system, so in other words, the apparatus or the environment and the system and the interaction together, quantum mechanically, I haven't said the word classical once, okay? They define a special basis for the system, a special basis of states which have this property that they evolve without getting entangled. Now, if you take a general superposition of those system states, they will evolve in a way that will become entangled in a different way with pieces of the apparatus or the environment. And when the environment is very large, then you have decoherence, and the system subpart that kind of system entanglement will not survive for long, having interactions with the environment. What those system states are not something that's God-given ahead of time by the word classical. This is a quantum theory. You don't even have to say the word classical once. Okay? But what they are is the property of the nature of the interactions. Now, there is some property of our world that the interactions are local, at least approximately. Forget about the fancy schmancy stuff to do with gravity. They're approximately local, okay? And if they're approximately local, that's what makes things that look roughly like position or momentum or coherent states and things like that. That's what makes those preferred basis states for things that we see around us. It's locality that makes that the case. And that's what begins to allow you to go from the underlying quantum description to something that looks approximately classical. But really strictly, all you need is infinity. You don't need even a classical limit. And by now, we understand plenty of quantum theories don't even have classical limits. We also understand that that you can have quantum theories with several classical limits. So this relationship between classical and quantum, which never conceptually made sense, went from classical to quantum. Not only did it not conceptually make sense, we now have several counterexamples to it, where you have just genuinely quantum systems, or as I said, quantum systems with several different classical limits. So you might object to having the infinity in to begin with, and that's just life. It's true that to define things quantum mechanically perfectly, you do need to have these infinities. And I have nothing to say about that other than that the one place at least we know where that infinity issue becomes impossible to realize, even in principle, forget about practice, even in principle, involves the words gravity and cosmology. Okay. So as to whether in general, this is, I think, a part of the general philosophy of radical conservatism, which is, I think, the best philosophy it's at least a philosophy in theoretical physics with the best track record, is you take the theories you have and you take them as seriously as you possibly can and you push them till they break, not until they make you uncomfortable or you want them to break or you want to replace them with something else, but you just keep pushing them till they themselves break. So I think all of these arguments say there's nothing going on in quantum mechanics that isn't explained internally, perfectly coherently within quantum mechanics, until you say the words gravity and quantum and gravity and cosmology. Yes?
So in this sort of a system, if the light was flashing up and you thought up,
yeah,
why would there be any confusion regardless of what the spin was, whether up or down?
Indeed, you're right. So if it's up, then I mean it depends what you're doing, right? I'm abbreviating a little bit what the whole process is, right? Because the whole process, I mean, if you just walk into a room and you see an apparatus and the light is flashing up, right? I mean, you have to believe that an experiment was done in order to give this result. Otherwise someone could have someone could be putting a light behind the apparatus to make it flash out of there where it says up, even though no experiment was done, right? So as part of whether you believe in the, so if you want to be definite about if the light is up, then yes, it doesn't matter whether the spin is up or down. But really what I'm assuming here is that we had the entire experiment. In other words, we started with the apparatus in its ground state, me in neutral state, okay, and the system in alpha up plus beta down, and then that system evolves to up, up, flashing up, down, down, flashing down. Yeah. Yes?
First question, can you get rid of all this question of like preparing states and such? And like, so again, like, you know, say, suppose you just walk into a room, you see it flashing up, right? Somebody could have just like
put
two wires behind the apparatus.
That's right.
So can you get rid of all this by starting with a state? You know, you start with a state on your subspace that says, I think, you know, I am pressing the button that says fire spin up electron, and then you time evolve some line later, I see green light flashing, I see red light flashing. Can you sort of get rid of the intermediaries and just look at your own subspace, calculate transition probabilities?
If you just look at your own subspace, because of the entanglement, you won't get something new. I mean, if you want to have something totally unitary, then you have to keep track of everything. And since all of these issues have to do with how various things are getting entangled with each other, if you want to ask questions about that, you have to talk about everything.
Yeah. So I suppose one way of saying this is that there is no such thing as a definiteness operator that just acts purely within the Hilbert space of the observer. Yes.
Can you define those states a little more precisely? The three states, the actual state, your apparatus state.
Well, the apparatus state I can define relatively precisely. It's a state of a bunch of photons of green light that coming through some direction. The state of I think up I can't define more precisely. I don't understand how my brain works. But presumably there's some state which involves me being certain that it's up. Yes.
So presumably also. We're back to the question of I see a quantum computing operator. So let's get rid of like this question about your friend and like the electron, whatever. Just look at, instead of measuring the IC up and IC down basis, because that's clearly not a big enough basis to represent your Hilbert space.
Yeah.
Just measure in the IC up and I don't see up basis, right? So that's clearly, you know, you have one vector, maybe one state vector. Or, you know, even a subspace that's IC up, and then you have another subspace that's I don't see up. And they're together, you can find a basis within those of the entire space. So, and you can show, like, using decoherence that you'll always evolve into one of those subspaces, and you can find relative probabilities.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, instead of, so you've, like, created these two subspaces using the proposition, I see the electron up.
Yeah.
You get these two subspaces. So now you ask, why do I always see, you know, a definite outcome rather than a quantum superposition. So you can, it seems like, naively, you should just be able to define, again, a proposition, I see a quantum superposition. This gives you a subspace of states of you know, U states, in which you see a quantum superposition, another subspace in which you don't. And, assuming that this operator is not a zero operator, assuming that there is any eigenvector, it seems like, again, if you do the experiment, of course, you're just doing it in different basis, but you'll still end up with either, you know, a classical mixture. You'll still end up with this wave vector where you can calculate relative probabilities for I see something in a quantum superposition and I don't see something in a quantum superposition.
Well, I mean, I'm saying that the phrase see something in a quantum superposition is something that you have to define correctly.
But I mean,
and so
that large argument, I mean, you can't define IC red correctly. So, you know, what's the difference, sort of?
No.
I mean, you can certainly define photons of a certain energy are in this certain location.
Right.
But, you know, if you're blind, that still won't cause IC red.
That's true. And so, if you're blind, you won't know the outcome of the experiment, and you won't be definite. So, I mean, it's but so I mean, really. So I mean, you know, this is very similar to when one is first learning relativity. You know,
you think about 15 million paradoxes and go back and forth, and eventually you just settle that it's Lorentz transformations. You learn it. You don't have to keep inventing 15 million paradoxes. And I really encourage you to do this with this example. I really claim there's absolutely no logical difference between the apparatus flashing, what you think, what your friend thinks, anything else. But just take every paradox that you can imagine and just run it through an argument, but try to really see if the operators that you want to exist can exist. And I also encourage you to read Coleman's paper on the subject, which also talks about a lot of these things. But yes?
Just wanted to ask a question about the construction of the definiteness operator. Then it's essential, if I understand right, it's essential that it be degenerate in its eigenvalues?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, because there are several different situations under which you might be definite.
All right, okay. So it's basically an observable corresponding to whether you have made up your mind?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm sort of confused because you did use the word classical when defining the probabilities of time beta. You did say there are classical probabilities.
No, I said that as a shorthand. I really mean those are probabilities that reflect an intrinsic uncertainty of what the state is. They're like the probabilities we're used to in classical mechanics, but I didn't have to say the word classical. In fact, I never have to say that word at all if I imagine I'm beginning with a pure state. If I'm beginning with a pure state, then I don't even have to say that.
It's just I was talking about the different kinds of probabilities that of just not knowing, just picking from some ensemble what the state of the system is. Remember, all of these things you're imagining doing by doing an experiment over and over and over again. So the infinity, there's multiple infinities. One infinity is the size of the apparatus. The other infinity is the number of identical copies of the system that you prepare. And so so the classical probability that I'm talking about is really just that in this infinite set, they're not all prepared identically. They're prepared in two ways. And there's some relative frequency of the two ways. So that's and so every time you pick one out of the big bad systems to do the experiment on, you don't know which one you're getting. Yes?
So there is another problem rising from the definiteness operator. It's in, by definition, it's not observable. Because if you observe it, for example, for me who has done an experiment, for someone who has done an experiment with a spin one half particle, whatever he or she may have seen, the result is one. So you can't, in principle, find out if this spin was up or down.
No, that's because the definiteness operator is not the operator that measures the spin. It's the operator that measures whether you're certain of the outcome of the experiment. And there are definitely states, for which you're not certain. As I said, you could just be confused. It could be flashing up, your brain could be down. You know, you had too good a time the previous night. You're like not thinking straight, right? There's lots of states for which it's not. There's lots and lots of states which are not every old state is not considered the definite state. However, any linear combinations of sensibly definite things are also eigenstates of the definite software. And it's really, as I said, you know, run through any argument, objection you have against this to the question of understanding, something which for sure doesn't involve consciousness and how I feel, but involves the very nice question of why it is that when a spin zero resonance decays in a cloud chamber, what you see coming out is a straight line. It's exactly the same, it's precisely the same question. Yeah?
What I mean is that by definition, you can't define, I mean, it's not possible to observe if we can't see the superposition state or the pure state, which is not in a superposition.
I'm not sure what you mean by definition. I gave you examples of states that are not eigenstates of the definite software.
What I mean is that what we see in such a measurement is either up or down.
That's right.
But going through this argument, we can't, in principle, if by definition, we can't find out if it doesn't predict it.
That's life about quantum mechanics. You can't predict it. You can't predict it. You have to do the experiment infinitely many times. When you do the experiment infinitely many times, you can predict something else. So I think this is something many of you have probably not seen this. But let me just I said it already, but let me say it like this. You see, you never have to say the words probability when you do quantum mechanics. Okay? You can stick with this idea that all you're talking about are eigenstates of operators, and if you have a state which is the eigenstate of some operator with some eigenvalue, then it has that definitely, and otherwise you throw up your hands and you don't say anything. Okay? But the point is that if you take this state, if this is 1 over root 2 and 1 over root 2, it's not anywhere near being the eigenstate of the spin-up operator. So you don't say the word probability, you don't say anything. You just say, oh, well, I don't know what it is. But if you do this experiment infinitely many times with identical or a large number of times with the first particle, the second particle, and so on. So let me abbreviate this state as alpha up plus beta down to the n, then you can show that as n goes to infinity, that if you look at the number of upspins divided by n, the net upspin divided by n on the state psi n becomes alpha mod squared psi n as n goes to infinity. So this state becomes an eigenstate of the average number of upspins operator with eigenvalue alpha mod squared. Okay,
So you never have to say the word probability, as long as you really carefully talk about the experiment that you're doing. Okay? This is obvious. I mean, so it's a nice exercise if you haven't done it to just do it. It's a consequence of just the binomial theorem here. Okay? But it's also obvious because this object, the sum of all the spins divided by n, that object actually becomes classical. The commutator of two of those objects goes like 1 over n as n goes to infinity. Okay? Now, there's a subtlety in this argument, of course, because this state is becoming infinitely large. Okay? So you have to ask, what precisely do I mean by this? And this is where you can do a little epsilon delta. Okay? You say that a state with confidence epsilon is an eigenstate of an operator if it's in has a value lambda if it's within delta of being an eigenstate. You define within delta of being an eigenstate by some any old method you want. You know, is there some lambda such that O on psi minus lambda times psi, that vector has a length less than delta. Okay, so that's a measure of how close it can be to being an eigenstate. Then if you put those epsilons and deltas in, so you've introduced a notion of confidence that you may not like, but you introduce it. By the way, whether you like it or not, experimentalists like it and do it all the time. Okay? Then if you do the experiment often enough, there's some big enough n for which you become within any confidence that you like an eigenstate of that operator. So that's what allows you to define this limit. Okay? So that's just saying that when you do the experiment infinitely many times, that does have a definite outcome, even without, and so that's what we actually do. So the fact that when it comes out once, you don't know, that's just life. It's true that you can't say if it's up or down. What you can say from the definiteness operator argument is that it's definitely, that you're certain of the outcome, whatever it is. You haven't said what the outcome is, but you can say that you're certain of the outcome, even after doing the experiment once. However, if we take the same state, do it many, many times, and then ask a different question, ask for the net spin-up operator, then that's something actually, that is something for which this state becomes an eigenstate of that operator with the appropriate eigenvalue. Okay. Yes. By the way, this is the calculation. This is the only calculation that was done in Hugh Everett's many worlds paper. It's I didn't say the word many worlds. The words are totally irrelevant, but it's a nice little. It's a pretty obvious calculation actually. But that's the only context to what. As far as I can tell, it's the only content to what you did. And it's a nice thing. I would encourage you to go through this argument.
Who's the author that you mentioned for the definiteness operator?
That's Sidney Coleman. But as I said, it goes back to this argument of, I believe, Walter Turing from the 1930s, who talked about the cloud chamber things. You know, it's funny, but somehow there's a sense developed, I think, in the last 10 or 20 years that this is the first generation of people to seriously think about quantum mechanics. I mean, quite the contrary. The people who invented the damn subject worried about these things an enormous amount, as you might imagine. And they were not a bunch of idiots. And, you know, and they thought about these very, very nice, very, very nice problems of, you know, like this cloud chamber problem. It's a beautiful thing. One experiment, one outcome. How come you see it coming out as a straight line when it's an S wave? How come you always see it as a line? This is decoherence, everything. All of these things were already discussed and understood by these guys a very, very long time ago. Not quite so explicitly as now. So I think some really great things happened in the last 30 years to be ultra explicit about these things. But that's, I think, what's going on. So one could spend a long, long time talking about this. I don't want to rush the discussion, but part of the reason is I'm sure you're going to have an entire course dedicated to these things. Yes?
Sure, let's think about it.